This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, as thousands of demonstrators protested outside, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a closely watched set of cases. The issue is whether colleges and universities should be barred from the use of race as a factor in selecting students. This historic debate on affirmative action revolves around the University of Michigan. One of the cases heard today is about the undergraduate school, which uses one set of standards. The other is about the University of Michigan Law School, which uses another. In many ways, the issues are even broader: fairness, equality, opportunity, and history. The last time the court visited this issue was 25 years ago in the famous Bakke case. Back then, the court struck down racial quotas, but in a divided decision, it left room for race to be considered as a factor in the admissions process. The court's ruling in the University of Michigan cases is expected to come down in July and will affect the future of affirmative action programs across the country. Later this hour, we'll hear from both sides of the argument for and against affirmative action, and we want to hear from you. Where do you stand on the issue of affirmative action? Is diversity a desirable, a compelling goal on our campuses and in our society? And if so, are college admissions the way to achieve it? But first, we'll have an opportunity to listen to excerpts from today's historic debate. The High Court deemed this issue so important that it released same-day audio of its arguments for just the second time in history. The first was Bush v. Gore. What we'll hear now is a dialogue between Solicitor General Theodore Olson and Justice Stephen Breyer. Solicitor General Olson is arguing on behalf of the Bush administration that the University of Michigan policies are unconstitutional, and he begins this dialogue.
This court has repeatedly held that race-neutral means must be demonstrated and will be accepted, the court will not accept the proposition that race-neutral means will not be successful unless they've been attempted and demonstrated. This program at the University of Michigan Law School fails every one of the court's tests. First, it's a thinly disguised quota which sets aside a significant portion of each year's entering class for preferred ethnic groups. Secondly, it overtly employs stigmatizing and divisive racial stereotypes, what the law school calls diversity-relevant characteristics. It identifies persons by diversity-relevant characteristics.
Well, what they do is they use race.
Exactly.
I mean, they have a reason for it. The reason for it is they want to produce a diverse class, and the reason they want to do that, using it as a plus, they say, is to do the things I said before. They think it breaks down stereotypes within the class. They think it's educationally beneficial. They think it supplies a legal profession that will be diverse. And they think a legal profession like business and the military that is diverse is good for America from a civics point of view, etc. Breaks the cycle. All right, those are the arguments, which you well know. So what is your response?
Well, a response to those many arguments is that they're using stereotypes to, in an effort, they say, to break down stereotypes. They're using race as a surrogate for experience. And if they want to look at experience, they can look at experience. If they want to improve the educational opportunities of minority groups, one of the biggest problems...
Well, that's not what they say. They say they're not using race for as a surrogate for anything, because if you have a person who went to Exeter, is very rich, and happens to be black, and is a conservative Republican, it's great for the class to know that, too. And that's why they want a certain number.
But that person, if he went to Exeter and he has a great GPA and so forth, gets an extra opportunity. A portion of the class is set aside for that individual solely on the basis of race, irrespective of his experience. And the application isn't examined for the type of experience or the type of viewpoint that race diversity characteristic is used as a substitute for any examination of the individual on the individual.
Solicitor General Theodore Olson in a colloquy with Justice Stephen Breyer at the Supreme Court earlier today. We're going to hear more of the tape from the Supreme Court in a few moments. But joining us now is Jeffrey Rosen, who teaches law at George Washington University. He's the legal affairs editor at the New Republic and was at the court to watch and listen to the arguments this morning. And Jeffrey, good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Kirk Colbow is the lawyer for the white plaintiffs in this case. Solicitor General Olson offered his support on behalf of the administration. What was the gist of their argument?
The gist of their argument was rather different from the one that they'd offered in their brief. In their brief, they'd said that the court doesn't have to decide the crucial constitutional question of whether or not diversity is a compelling interest, as the court had held in the Bakke case, because race-neutral alternatives were available, such as the 10% plans adopted in Texas that would allow universities to keep up the numbers without explicitly considering race. What was so interesting during the argument today is that Olson seemed to back away from that compromise. Right after the exchange that you just played with Breyer, O'Connor tried to pin him down and asked him...
That's Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
Precisely right. Do you agree, she said, with the articulated proposal of Justice Powell in the Bakke case that race may be used as a plus factor? And Solicitor General Olson said, we disagree. We don't believe that that's appropriate. So, in short, he made clear that he is urging the court not to hold that diversity is a compelling interest. He was pressed, are there any non-remedial justifications? He said, we don't want to say never, but this program fails. So that was the crucial legal move, and if the court embraces his view, as Justice Breyer was pressing him in his questioning, it might well have dramatic consequences not only for university admissions, but also for the military academies. That was really the second really interesting thing that came out of the discussion today. The military academies had filed a brief saying, if we can't take race into account, then we can't get enough officers to actually have an integrated corps. And General Olson explicitly said, we don't agree with the proposition that black soldiers will only follow white officers, and we don't believe that it's appropriate to take race into account in the military academies or in society as a whole. So that seemed to surprise several of the justices that during wartime the government would take such a strong position against those articulated by the military academies themselves. But this went further than most people had expected as well.
Well, let's listen to some more of the tape. This excerpt starts with Justice Antonin Scalia challenging lawyer Maureen Mahoney, who's arguing on behalf of the University of Michigan.
Ms. Mahoney, I find it hard to take seriously the state of Michigan's contention that racial diversity is a compelling state interest, compelling enough to warrant ignoring the Constitution's prohibition of discrimination on the basis of race. The reason I say that is that the problem is a problem of Michigan's own creation. That is to say, it has decided to create an elite law school. It is one of the best law schools in the country, and there are few state law schools that that get to that level. Now, it's done this by taking only the best students with the best grades and the best SATs or LSATs, knowing that the result of this will be to exclude, to a large degree, minorities. It's not unconstitutional to do that, because that's not the purpose of what Michigan did, but it is the predictable result. Nonetheless, Michigan says, we want an elite law school. Now, having created this situation by making that decision, it then turns around and says, oh, we have a compelling state interest in eliminating this racial imbalance that we ourselves have created. Now, if Michigan really cares enough about that racial imbalance, why doesn't it do, as many other state law schools do, lower the standards, not have a flagship elite law school? Solves the problem.
Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in this court's cases that suggests that the law school has to make an election between academic excellence and racial diversity. The interest here is having
only if it claims it's a compelling state interest, if it's important enough to override the Constitution's prohibition of racial discrimination, it seems to me it's important enough to override Michigan's desire to have a super-duper law school.
Your Honor, the question isn't whether it's important enough to override the prohibition on discrimination. It's whether this is discrimination. What Michigan is doing benefits...
No. The question is whether or not there is a compelling interest that allows race to be used.
That's
and
correct,
Justice
Your Honor.
Justice Scalia's question is designed to put to you the fact that this isn't a compelling interest because it's a choice that the Michigan Law School has made to be like this.
Your Honor, the issue is whether it is sufficiently compelling to allow Michigan to take race into account in this limited fashion in order to provide a much better education for students of all races. The benefits are race neutral, Your Honor, and the burdens are really quite limited. What we're talking about
But the question put to you is that Michigan has designed its school in a particular way, and it doesn't have to do that.
But, Your Honor, there is a compelling interest in having an institution that is both academically excellent and richly diverse, because our leaders need to be trained in institutions that are excellent, that are superior academically, but they also need to be trained with exposure to the viewpoints, to the perspectives, to the experiences of individuals from diverse backgrounds.
That brings us to the question.
Maureen Mahoney, arguing on behalf of the University of Michigan, with Justice Antonin Scalia, among others there. Jeffrey Rosen, the argument she was making that the university is saying that achieving diversity is in of itself a compelling interest. How well did she do?
She did very well, and I'm so glad that you picked out that thing, because that was really the crux of the case in many ways. Maureen Mahoney argued that it's possible to have a compelling interest in both academic excellence and diversity. And she said all of the supposedly race-neutral alternatives supported by the Bush administration, such as 10% plans and socioeconomic disadvantage, will actually lower academic standards across the board. If you're concerned about meritocracy, she said, the alternatives are more of a compromise of standards than affirmative action itself. What was so interesting about that exchange is that Justice Scalia, followed by Justice Kennedy, explicitly said, why does Michigan need a first-rate public university? What's wrong with lowering standards across the board, even if that means that the University of Texas and Michigan will have to engage in remedial education for the people that are let in under these 10% plans? There's a brief filed by law school deans who said the Bush administration's position, if the Supreme Court embraces it, will be a formula for the destruction of the great public universities. It will mean that it's not possible to have high academic standards and diversity. And what was, for me, the most interesting part of the argument today is that Justice Scalia, in the exchange we just heard, followed by General Olson in his final statement to the court, said Michigan may not apply its elitist admission standards, to use his words, to one race but not to another. The alternative is to lower standards across the board. And then Justice Ginsburg jumped in and said, yes, but then you're not just talking about Michigan, you're talking about Harvard and Yale as well, because according to federal statutes, they can't receive federal funds if they discriminate in ways that the court has said is unconstitutional. So we were getting a glimmer in this exchange of the consequences of a ruling that said you can take race into account as long as you don't do so explicitly and as long as you lower standards for everyone. This might have consequences not only for the elimination of high standardized test scores at public universities, but even at private ones as well. So the consequences could be very, very grave indeed, and one had a sense of that in the courtroom.
Obviously, these are issues of enormous import. Jeffrey Rosen, though, I have to ask you, isn't it a little unusual to, in the midst of this hugely important case, to hear a justice of the United States Supreme Court say the word super-duper?
Well, Scalia is colloquial, and that's what you can call it, elitist, or I actually like the term super-duper better, because the question is, that's the big constitutional question, are we going to have super-duper public and private universities in this country? And I fear that if the Bush administration's position is adopted, according to Scalia's own logic, we may not have very super-duper universities.
We just have a minute or so before the break. Can you summarize how the justices, or at least how conventional wisdom thinks the justices break down on this issue?
Oh, conventional wisdom, for what it's worth, might be that the four justices are fairly committed to the proposition that race can never be used except in remedial consequences, which would mean essentially that the Constitution is colorblind. Four justices seem pretty sympathetic to the idea that race, if used for benign reasons rather than openly discriminatory ones, may be used. And Justice O'Connor has not tipped her hand, but she was clearly very concerned today. She asked it twice about the prospect that these preferences will never end. She said, what is the stopping point for all this? And although she may be struggling for some sort of compromise that would allow the universities to take race into account as long as they don't do so too much, one almost had the poignant sense that her options were limited, and that once General Olson retreated from the Bush administration's claim that she doesn't have to decide whether diversity is a compelling interest, she may in the end not be able to split this particular baby and will have to decide the fate of affirmative action in America.
We're talking about the Supreme Court as it revisits the issue of affirmative action for the first time in 25 years, and we'll take your calls at 800-989-TALK. Where do you stand on the issue of diversity and how to achieve it? Our email address, totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the United States Supreme Court and its reexamination of affirmative action in higher education. We're going to be hearing from proponents on both sides of the argument, and we want your telephone calls at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. You've heard a little bit of the arguments in front of the Supreme Court today, and you'll get to hear some more. But we want to finish up first with Jeffrey Rosen, Associate Professor at George Washington Law School, Legal Affairs Editor at the New Republic. And Jeffrey, before you go, can you put this case into context for us historically? What are some of the court decisions that preceded this? Bakke, of course, and why is this happening now?
Well, it's such a rich history. The question of whether the Constitution is colorblind takes us all the way back to the Plessy versus Ferguson, the infamous case that legitimated separate but equal railroad cars. Of course, Brown versus Board of Education most explicitly embraced the idea of colorblindness as an aspiration. But after Brown, the court never quite made clear whether benign, non-segregative, non-caste-affirming racial classifications were permissible or not. In the Bakke case, it seemed to say that affirmative, that the university area was different, and that forward-looking justifications to achieve a diverse student body, and in particular to achieve intellectual diversity, might be compelling enough to satisfy the Constitution. But we've had a great political and constitutional debate in this country during the past 20 years about whether non-remedial use of race really is permissible. And it's been an article of faith for Republican justices as well as politicians that the colorblindness ideal that the court looked at in the Plessy case but never quite embraced is, in fact, a constitutional command. This is so dramatic, has inspired such passions, really more people than I saw outside the court at Bush and Gore, perhaps more drama than has been at the court for a long time, because there's such fiercely held principles on both sides, colorblindness and justice, and most of all the political demands for diversity at all cost, which have led universities to adopt race-neutral alternatives, including lowering admission standards, because there's no political constituency for allowing the numbers of universities really to decline. So, as always, in all the hardest cases, there's not an easy constitutional answer to this. Justice O'Connor will decide this, as so many important cases of our constitutional jurisprudence, and I can't think of a harder case that she's ever had to decide.
Jeffrey Rosen, thanks for being with us. An exciting and historic day. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Jeffrey Rosen teaches law at George Washington University. He's legal affairs editor for the New Republic magazine, and he was with us on the phone from his office here in Washington. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Stanley Kurtz, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He has argued against the use of race in college admissions in an article that he wrote for the Weekly Standard called Liberalism versus Diversity, and he's with us in the studio again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
In your article, you say racial preferences are at odds with liberal principles. What exactly do you mean when you say liberal principles?
Well, Neil, in classic liberalism, we treat people as individuals, but affirmative action classifies people according to their group. And so that sets up a fundamental conflict between our classic constitutional principles and this newer notion of diversity and the related practice of affirmative action.
Does the idea of liberalism, does that set of ideas more appropriately, does it necessarily clash with diversity?
Well, that's the question, in a sense, that we're asking. I think it does, and I think what we see with affirmative action is that you get a cascading set of consequences that occur once you broach liberalism. Originally, affirmative action was established with the conscious notion that this is going to be temporary. Yes, it's a suspension of our ordinary liberal principles, but we're trying to do a kind of short-term improvement here. But as that happened, people found that they didn't really want to think of themselves as an exception to the correct liberal principles. And so we got a series of new philosophies and ideologies, we often call it postmodernism, that cuts very explicitly and clearly against classic liberal principles. And I think the conflict is fundamental and deep.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to calls in just a moment, but I want to play another excerpt from the court's case today. It's so unusual to have same-day audio from the Supreme Court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg here challenges Solicitor General Theodore Olson on the topic of how other nations have handled diversity issues.
We're part of a world, and this problem is a global problem. Other countries operating under the same equality norm have confronted it. our neighbor to the north, Canada, has, the European Union, South Africa, and they have all approved this kind of, they call it positive discrimination. They have rejected what you recited as the ills that follow from this. Should we shut that from our view at all, or should we consider what judges in other places have said on this subject?
I submit, Justice Ginsburg, that none of those countries has our history, and none of those countries has the 14th Amendment. None of those histories has the history of the statements by this court, which has examined the question over and over again, that the ultimate damage that is done by racial preferences is such that if there ever is a situation in which such factors must be used, that they must be race-neutral means must be used to accomplish those objectives, narrow tailoring must be applied, and these programs fail all of those
General
tests.
Olson, and
Stanley Kurtz here, that again, an excerpt from today's Supreme Court hearing on affirmative action. Stanley Kurtz, is there something unique about American that prevents us from using race as one factor in the higher education admissions process?
Well, I think that the United States has upheld classic liberal principles more than many other countries. And, you know, that was a fascinating exchange. And Justice Scalia came back in that exchange and said, well, now that we have a kind of test case looking at Europe, Canada, what is happening there? Are they suspending affirmative action after a certain number of years, or does it seem to be entrenched? And, of course, the answer that General Olson gave was, in these countries outside of America, diversity has not gone away. It has not been temporary. And that gets back to Justice O'Connor's concern that once she okays this, there'll be no turning back.
Let's get to callers. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email questions, TOTN at NPR.org. And our first caller is Carrie, who joins us from Novato, California.
Hello. Thank you for having this discussion.
Sure.
I just wanted to chime in because this is really important to me. I went to Michigan Law School about 12 years ago, and when I arrived, I found I had two black roommates, one from a suburban environment, and the other, though, was from the inner city Chicago, and I was just out of undergraduate, and it was a real challenge to me. It's something that I have reflected on for the rest of my career. When I deal with people of another color, another culture, I think back to that experience and how I really thought I was one way and thought I was fair and thought I understood and didn't. And I don't know how I would have gotten that experience. Also, it's so important to go to a good law school. If, you know, the value of being at Michigan to my career has just been immense from the beginning and the number of companies and law firms that court you to throughout, you know, still 12 years later, people are happy and impressed to know that I went to this school across the country.
So you would agree with Justice Scalia was super duper?
More than super duper. I agree with the attorney who was arguing that, you know, I don't know how you get leaders without having the best schools, and I don't know that just having private law schools that are you know, the top rank would do these kinds of things. And also, and I'm Caucasian, as a Caucasian person who did not grow up with people of other colors and other races, I don't know where I would have learned how, you know, how my perceptions are other than by having to be right in that room and face my, you know, my roommate and try and understand what she was saying. It really was so vital to my career.
Stanley, the caller speaks to the value of diversity, not just to the minority applicants, but to all of the students.
Right. This is being fought out right now intensely. We saw a debate today in the courtroom on just this issue. We have a number of studies that argue that exactly what our caller has said is true. We get a wonderful acceptance, knowledge, breaking of stereotypes of other cultures from affirmative action. On the other hand, as Justice Scalia pointed out today, there seems to be another effect, that affirmative action for many people increases resentment, increases racial stereotyping. It also encourages people who are brought in under affirmative action to think of themselves more as part of a group than as individuals. So we've got, I think, both of these effects going on. I happen to think the latter effects are more powerful and disturbing, but clearly that is the issue, and as I say, this was debated heatedly in the court today.
Carrie, I'm sure you've been following this case at least to some degree, and you have to know that the case against the law school is being brought by someone who applied and did not get in. They thought unfairly that they were perfectly well qualified and that people with lower qualifications got in simply because they were minorities. If you didn't get in, if you didn't get those wonderful opportunities, might you feel the same way?
I listened to that person and I heard her situation, and my first reaction was to say, you know, that could have been me, you know, but for another hair's breadth on my scores or something I did in some class, I could have been in that same situation. But I really look back to what I did experience and the importance of having those individuals, particularly, you know, directly my roommates, but also just in the class. We all joked at University of Michigan that there were these old photographs and the ivy-covered halls, and there's these paintings and drawings of the old white men in the back of all the lecture rooms. And I haven't been back in a number of years. I don't know if they've changed this, but we all kind of joke, there's the old white guys on the back of the walls.
Tom Lehrer's great line about ivy-covered professors on ivy-covered walls, yeah.
But that wasn't the case in the classroom. And there were individuals who had tons of opinions, and not only in class, but in associations. And they really felt the diversity right away. Michigan is not a quiet, small place. I mean, it's a place where opinions are really important, and you learn a lot about the world around you because everybody's got an opinion, believe you me, on the mm-hmm. quad, and the law school is steps away from the quad. And if you were to change that vital feeling of you are in the middle of the world and the people who are here are going to go and change the world, it would be a much diminished institution.
Carrie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Colin. I hope I'm getting that right. These days there's so many Collins and Colins, you never know what to say, who's on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi there. So the way I see it is that we're kind of missing the point on this. Affirmative action is a Band-Aid measure. If successful law school applicants are not representing the racial makeup of the state of Michigan, then perhaps that's because we're not educating people earlier in their lives in a racially non-divisive way. Perhaps the way our public elementary schools and high schools are being funded creates this lack of diversity in higher education.
So the problem then would be through K-12, you're saying?
Exactly.
Stanley Kurtz, a reply?
I think the caller is exactly right. I think the real problem is at the K-12 educational level, and affirmative action in higher education is essentially a shortcut that has a lot of problems, downsides, difficult consequences, and I do think putting more money into early education, and also there's the issue of changing the culture and how affirmative action plays into that. A lot of people argue that it's not until you put the highest standards on all people admitted to higher education that you really create the motivation for people in the early years of school to buckle down and do their best.
Colin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Stanley Kurtz, you just said that more attention ought to be paid at the K-12, as our caller suggested as well, and many people would agree with you, but somehow the emphasis, when it comes up to be decided, the emphasis always seems to be somewhere else. That, well, you're not going to get through the K-12. You know, if you put the emphasis there, then you say, well, no, you really need it at the college. It always seems to move. The target always seems to move.
Well, Neil, we had a really fascinating experiment when California passed Proposition 209, which eliminated affirmative action in higher education. And then we saw that there was, in fact, an interesting change. The University of California established a program called the Berkeley Pledge, which sought out students, not on the basis of race, but on the basis of whether they had parents who had higher educational experience. And, of course, people in minorities were disproportionately represented there. And they pick out these students and they follow them through the early years of their education and try to help to give them the background that will prepare them for higher education. Now, that was only established after affirmative action was eliminated. So to me, that says affirmative action is sort of a shortcut, and it won't be until we eliminate affirmative action that we do the hard work to really change education in the early years.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Alan's with us from San Francisco, California.
I just wanted to respond. First of all, Scalia was really raising a straw man argument, and I believe the purpose for his raising that straw man argument was to waste the pro-affirmative action lawyers' time responding to a weak argument such as, you know, a school like Michigan's going to lower its standards to admit minorities, which it doesn't have to do anyway, instead of the lawyer spending time making a more valuable point. And I just want to say, even though I'm not a lawyer, I do know that affirmative action is not based on skin color. This is a misnomer that's used to sort of prejudice people against affirmative action. Affirmative action is based on historical, deeply entrenched, persistent, and ongoing discrimination against groups of people who've been able to successfully demonstrate that they are a member of such a group to the federal government or various institutions. And the number one sort of mythology about universities that I would like to debunk is that no university in the history of this country, not Yale, not Stanford, not Harvard, not even when universities were virtually lily white and all male, did universities ever admit students based solely on grades and test scores alone. And the other myth is that there are whites with lower tests, I mean the myth that I would like to debunk, there are whites with lower test scores who get in all the time over whites and Asians, as a matter of fact, with higher test scores for all sorts of reasons.
Whether that's football or their parents went there or something else.
Yes. And, you know, these people, including these three students suing Michigan, you know, they never go after those whites with lower test scores who got in. They only seek out minorities that they believe had lower test scores. And they never go after these legacy programs, which are complete set-asides for the privilege.
Alan, I don't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to give Stanley Kurtz a chance to reply.
Sure.
Well, it's interesting. I personally don't like the legacies. I wish the legacies would be eliminated. But I want to speak to the larger point of the caller, which is that we give some level of special consideration to all sorts of things, where a person is born, whether they play the oboe, et cetera, et cetera. The argument of the plaintiffs in this case, and I think it's a very powerful one, is that this race in Michigan is not being used just as another plus factor. This is what, under the Bakke case, was declared legal. But according to the plaintiffs, in the University of Michigan, over a five-year period, the chance of a black student or a minority student being admitted with the same grades and test scores as a white was 234 times greater. And that, it is argued, constitutes really a separate track of admissions, a de facto quota, not just a subtle plus factor like all of these other plus factors, but effectively, as I say, a quota.
I'd like to respond to that.
Very, very quickly, Alan.
Yes. You know, they say there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And there's all sorts of reasons that, if those statistics are even true, there's all sorts of reasons why that may be non-legitimate. And there's all sorts of reasons why that, you know, those statistics might be false. And
got to go, Alan. I'm sorry. Stanley Kurtz, thanks for being with us. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about the future of affirmative action. Should race count and at what price? Join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Earlier, we played you excerpts from arguments before the Supreme Court today. Extraordinary to have same-day audio tape from arguments before the Supreme Court, just the second time in history. Joining us now is Angelo Ancheta, Director of Legal and Policy Advocacy Programs at the Civil Rights Project, a lecturer on law at the Harvard Law School, and he joins us by phone from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you what you thought of Stanley Kurtz's argument that diversity comes at the expense of the ideals of liberalism.
Well, I think there's a tension, I think, that one could acknowledge. If you see liberalism as solely the individual without any attributes, without any experience, without any sort of group membership. And I think what we're trying to look at in these cases is the extent to which race, you know, being part of a group that is underrepresented at a particular university, should matter in terms of your individual application. So I think there may be some tension there, but I think it's certainly not meaning the death of liberalism if we decide one way or the other in this case.
Well, what is at stake here then?
Well, I think at the most basic level, we're talking about admissions policies that are at work in some of our most selective institutions. But I think the impact of the court's opinion, depending on how it rules and how broadly some of the justices decide to rule in this case, could have tremendous effects in terms of affirmative action policies, not simply in higher education, but in government as well as in the private sector. So it's tremendous importance.
So how does this spread out from a decision about admissions policies at the University of Michigan to cover all these other areas?
Well, certainly, Justice Ginsburg raised this in her argument. I think Justice Scalia was implying it in some of his questions, and that is, what is the breadth of the use of race in terms of public policies? And if one takes the point of view or the argument that the only constitutional interest that can be justified is simply remedying past discrimination by a particular institution itself, then that wipes out a lot of reasons, including diversity in higher education, but also diversity in employment, diversity in contracting, other goals that both government and the private sector might adopt.
We're going to play another excerpt now from the Supreme Court arguments today. This is where we hear the University of Michigan's lawyer John Payton attempt to justify to Chief Justice William Rehnquist how the school defines diversity.
If there are too few African-American students, to take that same example, there's a risk that those students will feel that they have to represent their group, their race. This comes from isolation, and it's well understood by educators. It results in these token students not feeling completely comfortable expressing their individuality. On the other hand, if there are meaningful numbers of African-American students, this sense of isolation dissipates.
What, Mr. Payton, what is a meaningful number?
It's what we've been referring to as critical mass.
Okay, what is critical mass?
Critical mass is when you have enough of those students so they feel comfortable acting as individuals.
How do you know that?
And I'm going to put you in the awful situation, Angelo, of answering the Chief Justice's question. Once you've decided that that's a goal, how do you go about and achieve that critical mass?
Well, I think what John Payton ended up answering in the oral argument was to turn to some of the social science evidence that was presented at the trial to look at the fact that when you have more than token numbers at a university, particularly at Michigan, and there's interaction among students, both in the classroom as well as in informal settings, that sense of tokenism, that sense of isolation, tends to dissipate. And moreover, the sort of stereotyping that you think, in fact, that students often bring to colleges because they have grown up in isolated settings is dissipated as well. And as students are able to interact with each other, they're able to understand that being Black or being Latino or being a member of an underrepresented minority group doesn't mean being lockstep one type of individual, that there are many opinions, many perspectives, many experiences that come in being a minority student.
Mm-hmm. Let's get the callers back engaged. Our number, 800-989-8255. And Diane is our next caller, and she's with us from Kingsland, Georgia.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, okay. I think I heard in the beginning arguments that were played back at the beginning of the show a statement that sounded like someone was saying, and it always bothers me to hear an approach that implies that standards have to be lowered or for any certain people to be part of an educational process. But I think when we make an assumption that standards have to be lowered, everybody is disserviced.
I think you're referring to Justice Scalia. And, Angelo, if I'm not mistaken, he was making a deliberate exaggeration there.
No, I think that's right. I don't think there's any question that the University of Michigan Law School is a top law school, or using Justice Scalia's term, super duper law school. But to the extent that the law school wants to maintain its excellence, to maintain its exclusivity, I mean, as an elite law school, it does face a challenge. But I don't think that you're necessarily having a trade off between academic excellence and the promotion of diversity. In fact, they have to go hand in hand. That's what makes Michigan a top notch school, is that it is also a diverse law school as well.
Diane?
Yes. Hi. Oh, okay. And that sounds good to me, but I think I've probably heard statements similar to that in other arguments on other situations, and it concerns me if an assumption is made, like I think people are disserviced. I also think that with the richness and the vastness of all the higher education that we have in this country, there may be room for many approaches if a university wants to make part of its mission a diverse student population, or for a university or a college, maybe to ignore diversity and make I don't know, the top SAT scores or the top whatever combination they look at, I think there's room for many approaches in how they choose, how students are chosen. And I think in the long run, as long as it's not all on one side or the other, I think that creates a diversity in itself that everybody benefits from.
Okay, Diane, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Let's go now to Roger, and Roger's with us from Macomb, Georgia.
Yes. I think that this, there's a division, and I think it's based on more than just skin color. I think it goes into conservatism as opposed to liberalism. Both sides have different constituencies, and as I'm sure you know, both sides take different tact on affirmative action. Of course, we conservatives, we have the money, and we have a big portion of the media. We're in power now, and why wouldn't the black population just want to go along and start thinking like we do, more conservatively? Hmm. And they'd get a little bigger piece of the pie, maybe.
Well, Angelo?
Well, I think that's a lot bigger question than just what's involved in the case here. I think what we're looking at is certainly a highly politicized and, you know, deeply where values and deeply held moral concerns are certainly at stake. And I think when we look at how the Bush administration in particular sort of took a more political stance and sort of articulating that diversity is in fact a compelling interest, but that race couldn't be used, it sort of was trying to carve its way through a middle ground that allowed it to maintain a constituency with minority voters, but yet still in some ways cater to the more conservative wing of the Republican Party in trying to, you know, strike down these policies. So I think that there's politics at stake. You know, in terms of the caller's question about why, say, African-American voters ought to maybe switch a bit or, you know, move more toward the right, I think obviously that's a bigger question in terms of how people's political values are being upheld and whether they think that, you know, moving further to the right is actually going to serve their interests.
Roger, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with Angelo Archetta of Harvard Law School about today's arguments before the Supreme Court in an affirmative action case that could be very influential around the country. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to read an email question that we got from Peter Tsang. Affirmative action, he writes, has always been feared by students of Asian descent. I'm Chinese American, and from very, very early on, we were told we must not fill out the little box that says we are Asians because it's generally accepted that works against us. People always seem to think of affirmative action as white versus black issue, completely dismissing and forgetting that there are very, very real victims. Asians of equally qualifying standards will always be dismissed in favor of either white or black students. In short, affirmative action is legalized racism against Americans of Asian descent.
Well, there's a question of whether that's factually correct. I think there have been some challenges in the past to, and there probably was in fact some discrimination against Asians in admissions in terms of setting caps, and that's been was something that happened in the 80s, and I think has been addressed. But I think the problem here is whether it's factually correct that Asians are being discriminated against. I think what is more really the case is the fact that whites and Asians, for the most part, are adequately represented racially in terms of admissions, and what you're looking at in terms of underrepresented minorities are students who are not able to get in without this extra plus factor that we see through diversity-based admissions policies. And I think it's incorrect to really label it discriminatory against Asians simply because they're not given that extra plus in some programs.
Let's go now to Tony, who's with us from Long Beach, California.
Hey, hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I want to congratulate you on your program. It's absolutely fabulous. And I just came on to say that, I mean, from everything I'm hearing, I've always supported affirmative action, not simply because I'm someone who has benefited from it, but also because as a teacher in high school and with kids now for 21 years, what I see is that we still, in our educational system with K-12, which is tying in with the other listener that you had talking,
mm-hmm.
I really think that between K-12, what we have is a situation where we have the high-performing kids who get extra help very, very commonly. We have our lower-performing kids who do get a lot of help. And a vast majority, I think, of the minorities that I see are in the middle. They are not necessarily getting the support they need, and there are some programs that are. And I think that this business of getting a critical mass of people that are a variety of types of experience and races and in a university is important just for a number of reasons. I mean, one I think is that it's in this global community that we're living in, with the world getting smaller, it's very important that we have people of all different backgrounds to be working together so that when they get out into the community, they can be more successful and contribute more to society. I think businesses in particular are extremely interested from some of the briefs that they filed in the case. And I think it's a social plus in a society which still has a number of issues on the racism, you know, front. And to sum it all up, I just think that the American dream, which I was raised to believe in, to give kids a shot at this American dream, they need to get into college to succeed.
Mm. Tony, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I just wanted to finish up with this last email we got from Mark in Auburn, Alabama. Are we suggesting, he writes, that law schools should lower their standards so minorities can get in? I am an African-American male, grew up in an Alabama public school system, lived in the ghetto, had parents who worked two or three jobs at a time in order to support me, and I still managed to make top SAT and ACT scores, went to a major four-year college of my choice, finished a five-year program in 4 years. I feel like those fighting for affirmative action are implying minorities are not cognitively equal to whites and have no chance to make test scores high enough to get into top schools. I feel we carry too many students too far. If they can't make the grades or scores, they should be cut.
Well, there's an assumption there that grades and test scores are all that ought to matter, and I think that there's no question that there are gaps in test scores among racial groups, but there are certainly, you know, there are going to be individuals who score quite well on tests. So I think the email writer, I think, is pointing to himself as an example of that, but clearly we're not talking about people who aren't qualified for law school. We're not talking about students who aren't able to succeed, and there have been plenty of studies showing, both at Michigan and at other major law schools, that the graduates of these schools who were admitted through affirmative action programs do quite well. They're leaders in the profession, and that diversity is really doing what it should do, which is trying to promote a leadership and you know, a profession that's really able to be representative of America as a whole.
Angelo Ancheta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Angelo Ancheta is Director of Legal and Policy Advocacy Programs at the Civil Rights Project and lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, and he was with us by phone from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For those of you who want to hear more about the Supreme Court's showdown on affirmative action, join NPR On Air and online Tuesday beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 4 p.m. Pacific, for a special report hosted by Frank Stasio featuring NPR's Nina Totenberg. You can also check your local member station for specific times. And, of course, Nina Totenberg will have an extensive report on today's arguments later today on this station on All Things Considered. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.